New from The Devil's Share, the podcast of Duke Magazine, The Race Course.
Because when we commit to an anti-racist mission, we will become a better and more perfect vision of the great institution I believe we are.
I don't know what people mean by anti-racist. I mean, I think I have an idea of what I think they mean, but I don't know how to do that. That's not what I do as an academic.
Race, anti-racism, critical race theory. Everybody is talking about race, and the only truly clear thing is that we don't even know what we mean when we say it.
So does anybody here know what affirmative action actually is? You're not alone. Part of it is because affirmative action is this really interesting collection of...
And they were told that they could have either an excellent white teacher or an unidentified mediocre black teacher.
And what I thought would happen to do what we do as academics is do an evidence-based course.
Duke University pledged to include anti-racism in its curriculum. That led to a new course available to every student, University 101, The Invention and Consequences of Race. A dozen or so scholars, 100 or so students, all committing themselves to figuring out what we talk about when we talk about race. The Devil's Share, the podcast of Duke Magazine, went along for the ride. And now, so can you.
Critical race theory is this buzzword, right? I like did not know what it was. I had heard the word, but I think one of the like powerful things is that like in its like simplest definition, it is literally just taking a critical look at like race relations in America through a context of history. And so I think that was really powerful.
Listen to The Race Course, the new series by The Devil's Share, the podcast of Duke Magazine, at dukemag.duke.edu or wherever you get your podcasts. In a large, light-beige lecture hall in the Biological Sciences building at Duke, almost 100 students wait for a class to begin its first meeting. The periodic table hangs on the walls, but this is not a biology class.
And welcome to University Course 101. You all are guinea pigs. You didn't know that. It's the first time we've done a course like this. So welcome and thank you for coming along for the ride.
If that's a little hard to hear, well, welcome to University 101, The Invention and Consequences of Race. That's Carrie Haney, Duke Professor of African and African American Studies and Professor and Chair of Political Science. He's one of the four co-convening professors who created the course. Right now, he's doing his best to deal with the technological frustrations that will almost never allow the students involved in this semester-long class, the first of its kind, to forget they're in a true beta test.
And again, then the technology has been a disaster. That's the crazy thing. I tell you, these classrooms are ridiculous. The technology is sort of sad.
He's not wrong. In a course that braced itself for pushback against its unflinching, rigorous examination of the complexities of race, the first issues are quotidian.
I was trying to get the lights, but we can't figure out the lights. Professor Haney.
What, the next couple of slides. This is gonna take a little longer here.
I'm scared to even try to go to the internet.
100 students spread out in a lecture hall, trying to avoid too much COVID closeness, trying to hear each other through masks, and trying to hear the presenters in a room where no microphone seems to work for longer than a few minutes. Nobody said taking on race was going to be easy. Hi, you're listening to The Race Course, a podcast from Duke Magazine. I'm senior writer Scott Hewler, and we sat in all term on University 101, The Invention and Consequences of Race. Duke has committed itself to anti-racism. It is putting anti-racism even into its curriculum. At the exact moment, the culture hyperventilates about critical race theory and seemingly any attempt to squarely address centuries of American racism. So we wanted to ride along. What does it look like when a university asks its professors to do anti-racism? When the professors ask the students to learn about racism and race? We asked, and they invited us to sit in and listen as they took their first swing. Now you can listen too. This is episode 1 of The Race Course. In June 2020, Duke formally committed itself to anti-racism. Duke President Vince Price.
Because when we commit to an anti-racist mission, we will become a better and more perfect vision of the great institution I believe we are.
The commitment came after then-U.S. President Donald Trump had scheduled a campaign event in Tulsa, scene of one of America's most horrific racist massacres. Not only that, he'd scheduled the event on Juneteenth, now celebrated as African American Emancipation Day, commemorating the day in 1865 that news of emancipation finally reached slaves in Texas.
Frankly, I mean, the Juneteenth conversation really, you know, was one of many instances where we realized we don't have the basic idea of this country's history. And these are, you know, the best and the brightest of the country, you know, Duke University students and some faculty. We, you know, some of us didn't know when Juneteenth was, in fact, until this whole controversy erupted. So, I mean, that's kind of where we are as a country.
That's Amy Kwan, associate professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, with many co-appointments. She's also founding director of Duke's Asian American and Diaspora Studies program. She showed me a document created by a group of a couple dozen university faculty called the Power, Equity, and Reckoning Collective, which included not only Kwan and Haney, but the two other co-conveners of the University 101 course, geneticist Charmaine Royal and Don Taylor, professor of public policy and chair of the Duke University Academic Council.
This conversation was a year in by the time we got to this. And what happened was when the Juneteenth fiasco happened with Donald Trump, President Price made this announcement committing Duke University's resources to really expand our curricular efforts.
President Price.
We know what to do. We just have to care enough to do it. And we've all seen what this university can do, how we can mobilize in the face of crisis, as in the COVID pandemic. We will have to put our full institutional weight behind our anti-racist efforts.
Great. Of course, as Kwan notes, this is hardly new material.
And mind you, individual faculty, especially our Black faculty in African-American studies and other departments have been doing this heavy lift for, you know, decades. So our iteration was just one of many over time. Again, there was a convergence where all of these crises, both local at Duke University, nationally and internationally actually, culminated in the faculty coming together and working with the administration to try to launch this at a university-wide scale.
And when you think of a university-wide scale, you think of teaching. So with part of a $16 million grant from the Duke Endowment, a charge from a provost or two, and the next term not far off, Haney and a group of professors got started.
We got started with this late. We got hanging this assignment and it was a blank slate.
They distilled the large group of professors Kwan had mentioned, first down to 8 and then down to 4, a small enough group to actually work together to create and plan a course. Haney starts with an essential point.
I don't know what people mean by anti-racist. I mean, I think I have an idea of what I think they mean, but I don't know how to do that, right? That's not what I do as an academic. And what I thought would happen, and I think it's the best way to approach it, is to do what we do as academics, is do an evidence-based course.
That is, university administration is in the business of setting big priorities. But the professors don't just parrot statements or adopt rules. They follow those priorities into actual research and teaching, which is exactly what Haney told his students on that first day.
In designing the course, one of the things we wanted to make sure that we did was to design a scholarly, academic, evidence-based course. Let me repeat that, a scholarly, academic, evidence-based course. You know, race is a topic that lots of public interest in the topic of race, lots of conflictual conversations and debates about the issues of race. Race has been one of the most persistent social cleavages in this country since the country was founded. We wanted a course that was evidence-based and one that would hopefully solicit from you critique, questions, debate, and dialogue.
I'm going to actively engage the material and engage the speakers in the class. And at a university, I believe you should be able to say whatever it is you want to say if you have supported with logic and evidence. And that you're also willing to be challenged with logic and evidence.
The group of professors never stops pushing hard on the intellectual rigor with which they expect the students to engage the course materials, both in the course and elsewhere.
And one of the things that I hope that you will do as you engage the meetings and the speakers and each other, as you leave this class and engage conversation with folks not in the classroom, newspapers, news broadcasts, social media, one of the things I hope you would do is begin to say, how do you know what you say you know? And you should ask that of us all the time. Let me read something. How do they know what it is they're telling you? Another question you should ask is, so what? Right? I read something, so what? What am I supposed to know now that I've read something? So I always question, how is it that they know what they say they know? Where is the evidence? What is the evidence? And then hopefully you begin to be able to consume and critique and analyze the evidence that someone presents.
That engagement is the class's key goal. But when Haney introduces Charmaine Royal, professor of African and African American Studies, Biology, Global Health, and Family Medicine and Community Health, engagement suffers a blow.
Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? No.
Once the mic is working, Royal introduces her discussion about race and biology with a poll, asking the simple question, what is race? More tech problems.
You were able to get on, others are not. I'm not sure what's going on, but we're going to go ahead and stop it now.
She uses a video from the American Anthropological Association to make straightforward statements about race having no biological origin so that she can use her time to investigate complexities.
Just like this painting, race was created. It is a powerful idea that was invented by society. Race is an enduring concept that has molded our nation's economy, laws, and social institutions. It is a complex notion that has shaped each of our destinies.
When she can get the projector to cooperate, she uses census records to demonstrate how even what the government considers race has constantly changed. Slaves and free blacks, for instance, used to be different races. Mexicans turned white in 1940. Though all the minority categories have rotated, one category has not. Can you guess?
See, that white has stayed the same. We have put some other words with it and taken off race and words. But white is the only category in the census that has remained the same since 1790. All other categories have changed. As somebody said before, Italians were not white at one time. Over time, they became. So these categories are fluid. They have changed over time, which is one of the reasons that people are clear that this is constructed, it's made up, it's not in the blood, it's not in the genes.
Royal is a genetics PhD and has spent her career studying how ideas about ethnicity, race, and ancestry connect with biological sciences. She demonstrates one mistaken understanding by showing the students how the identification of sickle cell trait with black people is scientifically incorrect. She uses FST values, the proportion of genetic variance, F, in a subpopulation, S, against the total population, T, FST. FST values show human populations lack meaningful genetic variation beyond the surface.
In evolutionary biology, if a Wright's FST is 0.25 or greater, the chances are that that organism has subspecies, has genetic variation that's big enough to merit the definition of racism. Below 0.25, it's less likely that you can say that organism has races. When you look at human population, and you look at the genome, and you're trying to understand the variation, if you're looking across the genome in human populations, the Wright's FST is about 0.15.
Again, She's making powerful points that she has explored in her research, but she's trying to squeeze a term's worth of science into an afternoon, and she's wrestling with just being heard. It's not an easy class, and it doesn't feel like an easy start to a course about race.
You know, it's almost the end, and I will not forget the beginning, because I was a first lecturer. And I had a lot of information to impart, and the technology wasn't working, and I was a bit flustered because I didn't get, you know, I end up taking the whole session. I didn't really have much of a discussion session. So for me, and you may not keep this on the tape, but for me, my first session in my mind was a disaster just because it didn't go the way I was hoping it would go with being able to engage them in discussion. And I think because the technology was so wonky, I was thrown off.
Just the same, Royal raises and explains these powerful central concepts about race. She is trying to impart something foundational to the class. Biologically, race does not exist. This is not new. She cites a genetic biology journal from 1972. This is not controversial, scientifically, but she knows some of these students will be hearing it for the first time. She wants them to hear it. They need to hear it.
And I imagine I was invited to be on the committee because I work on race. That's been my work for the last, I don't know, 20 plus years or more. And I teach courses on race, and in particular one course called Race, Genomics, and Society. And for my work, I'm trained as a human geneticist and as well as a bioethicist. And my work is at the intersection of those disciplines. And so I always bring in the biological sciences along with the humanities and the social sciences.
And she says one of the reasons she supports the new class is that in her race genomics classes, which spend an entire semester on this topic that she covered in part of a single meeting.
I usually do a survey at the beginning of the semester, and at least invariably for every class, at least 25% of the students would say, when I do that survey, they would say, humans have biological races.
She asks this class a similar question.
But let me ask, how many of you, and be honest now, thought of race as invented, as made up, before you saw the title of this course? How many of you thought of it as something that was made up, or, you know, before you saw this course that said the invention? I mean, how many people said invention? Did they invent that? I thought it was real.
A good quarter of hands go up.
And so many of you thought, what? What did some of you think? I saw the responses, but I'm not able to tell what you learned from the readings and from the video versus what you knew before you registered for the class. So did many of you think it is all in the genes and it's biological for the most part?
And when the microphone works, students respond.
I feel like, I mean, it was like created. So like people who are in power have more power over like other people. So like they were able to like categorize people because they have more power. I feel like we have more
she
power
was
over
doing
somebody, like,
exactly what
you're gonna
he
be
knew,
able to do, like kind of use
bringing
it,
the work
like,
of the class
like
to external so, situations.
Yeah, that's what I feel about it.
You look back at the history of America and the immigration of Italian Americans and Irish Americans.
Prior to the course, a lot of my thinking about race was that it's largely based on kind of historical, geographical, where you're from. So that's probably what my notion of race was kind of before.
Geographical.
Like where your ancestors are from.
Where your ancestors are from.
There is no doubt. Royal is bringing up powerful material, and even with the technological limits, students are engaging. Some are surprised, but nobody challenges the information or Professor Royal. And despite the difficulties caused by the technology and the length of the meeting, the class is already having the exact effect the professors designed for it.
Okay, I was talking about how this class being pass-fail is really good for helping me with my reflection. Like, it being pass-fail wasn't something that deterred me from taking it, it actually encouraged me.
That's Eliza Moore, a freshman in her first term at Duke who is having her eyes opened by a lot of things. She mentioned the class was offered pass-fail, which is something the professors had a lot of thoughts about and will investigate later on. But when I started talking with her a few classes in, I asked Eliza whether anything in the course had already blown her mind.
Oh my God. I was nowhere on that, and now my eyes are open.
It's surprisingly enough, the race is like a non-biological factor was just hit me at the, and they hit us with that week one, and it just has been blowing my mind since. I actually shared that with like my family members, and because a lot of them, they never had discussions like this growing up either. So when I'm telling them about, I mean, they all went to college, but when I'm telling them like this is what we're talking about now, they're saying these are very different things than what we were learning when I was coming through school. So just learning about like these different like the race is not a biological thing. It's never something that you're told, but when you go to the doctor, when you're experiencing race on a daily basis, you just kind of assume it's biological because everyone treats it like it is. And so to learn that there were deeper powers behind this and it's all systemic and that it's like it was a carefully crafted way to tear people down. And then also the contradictions that they were highlighting, like they were saying slavery was okay, but they're also like a free country. So how do you justify these big contradictions? So those kind of small points that I'd heard about in history but never thought about before really clicked in for this class.
She was doing exactly what Haney hoped, bringing the work of the class to external situations.
As you leave this class and engage conversation with folks not in the classroom, newspapers, news broadcasts, social media, one of the things I hope you would do is begin to say, how do you know what you say you know? Always question, how is it that they know what they say they know?
One meeting, one class, where a lot went wrong. That's how changed she was after the first class. There was a lot more to come. Next on the Race Course, as the class gathers momentum, students learn more about race as a social construct, and students and professors learn about each other's expectations.
I did a creative project on Julian Abel last semester, for example. And just the ways Duke has, the shortcomings that Duke has had in addressing racism on campus. And so the main reason for taking this class was, other than I'm interested in the topic, is I really wanted to see how well or how thoroughly Duke was kind of like interrogating this.
Without knowing some basic foundational facts and events about race and U.S. history and politics and science, you can't have, I think, very good, productive conversations about these sticky issues that come up, or like a takeover or a renaming of a building.
More on race and debate next on The Race Course, a podcast from Duke Magazine.
I want you to take out your phones and text them, do you believe Pluto is a planet?
University 101, The Invention and Consequences of Race, is back in session, and students are listening to Duke Professor of Cultural Anthropology Lee Baker telling them about what he calls the anthropology of race.
And look at sort of some of the ironies between race, racism, and democracy, particularly in sort of formal colonial, countries that believe in equality, believe in justice, and believe in like freedom, but consistently articulate inequality, lack of freedom, and the like. And just kind of as an anthropologist, looking at those contradictions, you can explain a lot about what is going on in a particular culture. So that's kind of
Baker explains what a social construct is. Like, for example, whether Pluto is a planet. Pluto is an object zipping through space with mass and trajectory and velocity. That's just fact. But whether it's a planet, like versus an asteroid or a meteor or something else, that's invented. A planet is an invented notion, like race. Or, say, civilization. European settlers deemed both African slaves and Native Americans uncivilized, which allowed the settlers basically to do anything they liked with them. Native Americans fought that label, and one way they tried to demonstrate their civilization.
Part of their argument that we are civilized, and they call themselves the five civilized tribes, is they had a constitution, they were Christians, and they had slaves. So we're as assimilated as anyone, we should stay.
If you can believe it, the European settlers didn't think the Native American civilization meant they ought to be able to remain in their southeastern homelands.
And they were like, no, it's better for you. You're savages.
It's better for you to be moved. So that was, again, the rationalization. Both with slavery and Indian removal, there was this rationalization that because you're savages, being in contact with white people for slaves lifts you up, and being removed from white people lets you just do your thing if you're Native Americans.
Useful things, these social constructs.
But social constructs also have to be durable and believable, right? And when I say durable, it's not just a fad or something went viral one time. It has to be sort of grounded in history, and there has to be sort of a genealogy to it. It has to be rooted in something.
But defining civilization gets into the weeds, and Pluto is kind of distant. To further clarify a social construct, Professor Baker stays in the sky, but shifts to something much more ordinary than Pluto.
This is one of my favorite examples, because even though we know it's not true, we still believe. When you are walking on the beach and you're taking a picture for your Facebook page, you're not saying, this is us as the earth turns and goes into the shadow of the earth. People just say it's the sunset, and they believe it's the sunset. And you're not doing the third, fourth leap saying, well, the sun isn't really setting, the earth is turning. But this is a great example of it. Like, you know it's not setting, but it kind of looks like it's setting, so you're just gonna let it say sunset, and it's part of the culture, right? So that is not, that this is a type of social construct. And I think that's a beautiful example of it, because we all do it.
Even the sunset is a social construct. Helps put race into perspective. Hi, you're listening to The Race Course, a podcast from Duke Magazine. I'm senior writer Scott Hewler, and we sat in all term on University 101, The Invention and Consequences of Race, the class Duke created as part of its commitment to anti-racism. This is episode 2, where we address what we learned in episode 1.
Let me ask, how many of you, and be honest now, thought of race as invented, as made up, before you saw the title of this course? How many of you thought of it as something that was made up? How many people said, invention? Did they invent that? I thought it was real.
But okay, if race was invented, if it's a social construct, as Professor Baker says, well, why does everyone pay so much attention to something we just made up?
Just because it's socially constructed doesn't mean that it's not real, right? It has real life consequences, life and death consequences, that are very much real. And so we also need to think about the specificity of the local and the historical context, the spatial context, in which race is mobilized to do its thing. Ideologically.
That's Amy Kwan, associate professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies and one of the four co-conveners of the course. And her point was simple. We pay attention to race because people believe in it and because it accomplishes something some people wanted to accomplish. Listen to Gunther Peck, associate professor of history and public policy, who lectured a couple weeks after Baker.
If we think about the way we simultaneously deconstruct race, it's a social construct, it has a history, it's malleable, we get that, and then ratify its power to explain events. Give you an example. A good friend said about a year ago, George Floyd was killed because he had black skin. He was not killed because he had black skin. I would strongly dispute that. He was killed because of a systemic racist policy, and because a racist person killed him.
That is, George Floyd's problem wasn't that he had black skin. His problem was that racist people believe the things racists claim about people with black skin. People believe in that social construct of race, and they act on those beliefs. Not skin color, racism. Where Baker addressed the nature of social constructs, Peck talked about how the social construct of race affected things like people's actions. Personal, like the racist murder of George Floyd, and political, like U.S. immigration policy. Peck spoke on what he called immigrant whiteness. and he focused, again, not on skin color, but on the series of invented beliefs that people assign to it.
Why does that matter? If you think that skin color itself authorizes race and racism, you're naturalizing racism. You're saying that, in effect, the skin color is what creates the habits of mind and thought and the practices that are unjust, that are connected to racism. And that is understandable because, in fact, that is the world we live in, that there are consequences to skin color. But I would challenge you, right, that when you think about the origins of race, and especially immigrant whiteness, that it was not lightly complected skin that creates immigrant whiteness.
For example, one immigrant group that had a hard time being treated as white in the United States was Finnish people.
The fairest skinned immigrants in U.S. history are probably the Finnish American community, and they were not white by law in 1900. They're blonde, hair, blue eyes. Why would that have been? Census takers refused to put them in as white. And the reason being, they were farthest left of any immigrant group in U.S. history up to that point. They were syndicalists. They believed in one big union. They were communists, in effect, before the Russian Revolution. And they were viewed as dangerous to this nation, to what its founding creed is. Therefore, they were not considered white, which meant they could not naturalize quite the same way.
The United States government finding a way to treat the fairest-skinned people in the world as non-white helped clarify just how arbitrary both race and its consequences are. This led both Baker and Peck to ask not the what or how of race, but the why. Here's Baker.
So I want you to think, as I go through this lecture, what function does race have in a society that believes in equality, justice, freedom, and liberty, right? What function does it have? And some of these functions include managing population expansion, cheap land, and labor for the dominant group to stay on top, economically, culturally, as well as politically. And then it reconciles persistent inequality with individualism, liberty, and justice for all. So it kind of keeps ideas of meritocracy, keeps ideas of democracy, and keeps ideas of American dream sort of alive and well through this sort of rationalization process. So
race does work. It keeps the down races down, and not only keeps the up race up, but tells it that it's up because it belongs there. Baker discussed how people have used the law to enforce racism. He laid out the case of Elizabeth Key, an enslaved biracial woman in the mid-1600s, who successfully sued in Virginia colonial court for her own freedom and that of her son. Under British common law, the status of the father determined that of the child, and the Christianity of Key and her son also helped. You can guess the result.
So the Virginia Assembly got quick. By 1662, they had a law that said children born to Negro women are either free or slave depending on their mother's status. The baptism of slaves as Christians does not alter their status as slaves, right? Those two were directly in response to the Key case.
100 years later, in 1775, the notion of race had caught on. German physician and anthropologist Johann Blumenbach categorized the entire world into 5 seemingly scientific racial categories. And surprise!
So he believed that the people from the Caucasus, in Georgia in particular, were the most beautiful people in the world. He gets credit for giving us the word Caucasian and equating it to white.
Though they were based on the fiction of race, even the categories weren't the problem. The problem was the categories were hierarchical.
It was an explicit hierarchical position, which was very significant. And he also says, this is the varieties of mankind according to the truth of nature. Now, he was the only one who could discern this, but nevertheless.
With, naturally, the white race on top. Modern biologist and science historian Stephen Jay Gould, whom the class read for this discussion,
argues the shift from a geographic to hierarchical ordering of human diversity must stand as one of the most fateful transitions in the history of Western science. For short of railroads and nuclear bombs has more practical impact in this case, our most entirely navigative upon our collective lives. That's a lot. Is that hyperbole? Is he a little over the top? Is he making the point? Or is that true?
He's not over the top. It's not hyperbole. It is true. Hierarchically ranking races in a seemingly scientific way has had devastating consequences.
Because you do, you bring science in, but you also bring in state violence, power, all this bureaucracy, all this machinery, and really with force enforcing these hierarchies. So it is, you know, it was a big deal, but it took time to evolve. We used that case of the woman who fought for her freedom, and that one could have gone either way. 100 years later, though, it's locked and loaded. We have hereditary slavery with ideas of inferiority, and then there's...
The point is simple. In the United States...
At least by 1776, you got big-time hereditary slavery, ideas of inferiority, and the power, bureaucracy, and force to enforce it. So that's a pretty big difference in 100 years.
Of course, once race is baked in, racism develops as a tool of oppression. Baker described the gyrations the new country underwent to remove Native Americans from the South.
You get slaves coming from the North down into cotton country and moving the Indians out of cotton country and the Indian country all at the same time. This was total disruption of families, of people from their lands. So that was very culturally disruptive, nor the same agriculture, whatever. And also for families, because so much of that selling them down the river or that domestic slavery was breaking up families, and it was used as a tool to oppress people. So if you did not comply, we will sell your daughter. And it was a tool of real misery and real violence against kinship. And so these two things in the 1830s, I think, worked so much to bring race as we know it today. Just the total disregard for family structures, just selling pieces of people's families down the river to be in the cotton kingdom, at the same time removing the Indians from prime cotton land. This is not an accident. This was coordinated.
And in a subsequent class, Peck went into detail about how the nation used laws to resist immigrant groups it didn't like.
It begins with Chinese exclusion in 1882 as the first... one of the first exclusionary acts, the first time that we actually begin to have a border that excludes rather than welcomes or creates conditions for inclusion. And that act authorizes a whole set of other types of detention that come into being, the Angel Island in California, and then later, right after that, in Ellis Island in North America. Much of the way that immigration exclusion occurs is around questions of public health, very relevant for the current moment.
And how immigrant groups, though mistrusted and excluded, could nonetheless aspire to that socially constructed whiteness, and with it, a step up the cultural ladder. Whiteness isn't skin color, it's a status an immigrant can acquire.
But then we see immigrant whiteness for what it is, which is an ideology and a political strategy that has been contested from its origins, and not something that's authorized, naturalized by the color of your skin. There's no way to make sense of white supremacy in the United States without understanding some of those starting points.
Expanding on that notion, Amy Kwan spent her lecture reminding the class that race and racism are not exclusively North American problems.
I also want to, in this class, to try to broaden the conversation from a largely U.S. race relations focus to a more global focus. And as you have seen in your the earlier lectures, even when we focus on the U.S., it's never just about the U.S. We talk about immigration, we talk about biological science, the development of eugenics and so forth. These are all global phenomena. And so I encourage you, not only in this class, but in whatever you do in your other classes, your majors, you know, like your line of work and so forth, really try to think about crossing these divides and going across borders.
To outline matters sharply.
By 1900, 15% of Euro American power subjugated 85% of the world's people and territories, primarily in the Americas, Africa, and Asia. Wrap your head around that. 85% of the world were subjugated as colonies or informal colonies by this time. And this was a racial divide. There was a color line. White Euro-American powers colonized every inhabited continent. And this was the making of the world divide that took 400 or 500 years. So do you think it's just gonna disappear in 1945, 1947 with independence movement? We're still living with these legacies.
And with that legacy of colonization, Kwan notes, the United States has scrupulously avoided the word, but by the late 1800s, it was an empire. At the same time, Japan, the other late arrival to world colonialism, was also ramping up its efforts.
So by this time, imperialism and the word colony, the C word, was actually becoming taboo. And so we tried to avoid the C word. And so this idea of an anti-colonial imperialism was the new name of the game. But if you look at the various territories, so we call them territories instead of colonies, the different areas that we went into, Hawaii, the native lands, Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, U.S. Virgin Islands, all of this new territory was acquired around the same time that Japan was also expanding. But in fact, during the time, contemporaneously in the 1890s, when America was expanding its territories, it was actually obvious to everyone what it was doing, but in history, we actually have forgotten that similar legacy.
And that reminds people studying American racism that you can't focus just on United States racism against black people, or Irish or Italian or Chinese immigrants, or for that matter, those Finns. All those laws, all those rules, they all fit together.
So it's really important for us to think about these histories in a triangulated and connected way, rather than thinking about what happened to one group of people versus another and another as a separate history, which is oftentimes how we're taught these histories.
They're connected, of course, by the notion that European Americans, white people, are better. Kwan showed a political cartoon of Uncle Sam forcing highly racialized children representing island nations like Cuba and the Philippines to read a book on self-government.
This idea that these other people in other territories of different color, different race, were less civilized than you. Now, children, you've got to learn these lessons whether you want to or not.
Race was arbitrarily created and arbitrarily used by the white power structure to justify whatever it wanted to do. When the railroads needed labor, Chinese immigrants were good. When it came time for citizenship, not so much. The race of immigrants, like all race, is a shifting, changing thing.
So this idea of a reversible and interchangeable relation to the nation state, this place of in-betweenness, of never fully belonging, and always being pegged as perpetual foreigners. And so, depending on our foreign policy of the moment, we think about the good Asian versus the bad Asian, and then you become the good Asian again. And you see this, it's not just a fixed place. Once you attain your citizenship and your sense of belonging, it's a done deal. No, it's actually a constant battle.
As Professor Kwan finished her lecture, one student raised a question. Because the class took place in a lecture hall with students masked and distanced, student questions and comments often came out like that, muffled and hard to hear. As it happens, that question came from Senior Elizabeth Lociavo, who had expressed the same question to me earlier.
I have done a lot of investigative work through creative projects in the past, through my major and through extracurriculars that have looked at Duke's historical relationship with race. Looking at work from Local 77, the Workers' Union. I did a creative project on Julian Abel last semester, for example, and just the shortcomings that Duke has had in it, addressing racism on campus. And so the main reason for taking this class was I really wanted to see how well or how thoroughly Duke was interrogating this. It's much different, I think, to talk about race in the abstract and in an academic sense, but to actually analyze what have the our institutions' roles been in upholding this social construct in a discriminatory way, and like to this day, the ways that we still do.
The large room, the masks, and the separation could make such discussion difficult. But Kwan encouraged that line of thought, first reminding Lo Schiavo that the class was a first try.
This is our first iteration, and you guys are the pioneers, basically, coming on this journey with us. And as I said, you know, not all of us agree on the content of the course and who's going to, you know, be lecturing and the topics and the disciplines and so forth. And so, you know, my hope is that this is just one of many. This is not a one and done. And also, as you're taking this class and listening to some of the lectures, ask yourself, what about this history? What about the background have I known about? And what about this history? Is it completely new to me? You know, as students at Duke University, after a lifetime of an education system. And so I hope that will guide you in thinking about pursuing other knowledges and other connections and other ways of forming solidarity. Professor Baker mentioned that we are a historically white college and university. We often think about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, but we actually don't name the whiteness of the institutions that historically have been predominantly white, and in some cases still are. As I said, my colleagues, I am, the majority, 85% are white men. So we are definitely having these issues and debating them on a campus level. And so I would encourage you to also think about the place of the university and the solidarity movements and community building across aisles. So just don't hang out with the people that, you know, look like you. Make an effort, because this has been done before. A lot of those movements, actually, some of them ended up having success, but many of them failed, and often through great state violence. But I want to encourage you to think about this particular moment in the post-George Floyd moment, and with Black Lives Matter going viral again globally, and the reckoning of history, of which this class is a part, for you to really take an active role in pushing this conversation forward.
Regarding pushing the conversation forward, the four co-convening professors had discussed whether the class ought to have discussion sessions to facilitate the conversations that Kwan thought ought to happen. Kwan had been in favor of such sessions, but the group had decided against them.
I would have loved to have a discussion section, you know. I think we have a lot of cooks in this kitchen. There are some differing debates about whether that would be, you know, good for a course like this or not, who would actually, you know, lead those discussion sections. Some of the faculty felt that, you know, some of graduate students might not be as well trained or equipped to deal with some of these sensitive topics. Others of us think that, you know, these are precisely the reasons why we do have to have these small group discussions and so forth. And, you know, you can train graduate students along the way and so forth.
Professor Kerry Haney disagrees.
So the difficulty with discussion sessions, and I was one of the ones who was opposed to that, have been taught.
He describes teaching lecture courses with discussion sessions led by teaching assistants, but those were established courses whose TAs had taken similar courses and could easily lead students through the material. In this class, the material was new, TAs were untrained, and the material itself could be not only challenging, but upsetting.
You know, you have to have TAs who are competent to lead a discussion section, or it's not much use to have a discussion session. And that we couldn't, certainly not in the amount of time we had, I thought, fill some sections where we had TAs who were competent enough to lead discussion sessions. And the other complication, right, we didn't know what the guest speakers were going to say, right? We knew we had their readings, and that's one thing, but then their lectures, the big things they bring up from the readings, or different things they would bring in, and most have brought things other than the readings to their lectures. And having TAs who, again, not specialists, to contend with that in discussion sessions, I thought was not a good pedagogical way to proceed. But it's possible with some lead time, and getting a sense, we could have TAs who were trained and we work with them for some period of time to get up to speed what we could do.
Understandable. But the students wanted to talk.
I would say yes, and that's just because everybody's coming with different backgrounds. So I'm like a military brat. So when you're talking about like military conquest and the effect that the military's had on race, that was something that I would have loved to be able to talk more about and like learn from other people's perspectives. So in situations where you have like a very specific or personal view on some of these topics, it's kind of disappointing that we don't get to talk about it with one another. But being able to chat with each other in class or after class or chatting with professors can kind of help fill that area. But I'm hoping that in the future, as the course progresses, and that we stick with that and we can open it up to more discussion. And just, I think when we do open to discussions, though, the difficulty is going to be making sure the conversation is staying respectful and that we're still learning from one another while we're talking about such sensitive issues and conversations.
That's freshman Eliza Moore. Freshman Joshua Pickett felt the same.
Yeah, I definitely think discussion would be good. Based off of what she said, like learning from different people and their different backgrounds and stuff like that, and also being able to like kind of break down the material, because I definitely find the material to be a little dense sometimes.
I thought the same.
So yeah, I think a discussion would be a good idea for sure. I definitely find it helpful in my psych class, so I think it would be good in here too.
Pickett recognized that discussion could yield not just uncomfortable but even offensive comments, but he thought that would actually be helpful.
I think it might be a proper way to like confront it for sure. I guess, yeah, it can be sometimes like a tough topic to discuss and can be controversial, but I think there's a way that can be confronted, like with more, I guess an educated response, really, just to correct somebody. I mean, not coming at them, but just kind of like coming lightly at them and telling them this or that, like, maybe you should have said this way, or just kind of doing that in a way where they can understand, for sure.
And I also think that we're like bound to come into contact with those types of people throughout our journey at Duke, just because it is just different identities all coming together. And so I think that like being able to kind of, at least for me as like a first year, being it, if I was in a discussion and that did come up, I think it would actually be very helpful to kind of learn how to handle those situations and more of like a controlled setting with maybe, you know, we have an adult present. Oh, I guess we're all adults, but I still feel like a kid. Where we have like a professor to kind of help guide, you know, how we handle that, versus just kind of being, I don't know, in like the dining hall and someone says that and you're just like, I don't know what to say to this. So I think, yeah, exactly.
That was freshman Sonia Green. Junior Quinn Smith agreed.
Yeah, I think it would be easier to deal with those cases of microaggressions in discussion, because I remember there was a time where one student asked a question that essentially compared colorblind racism to sock preference, and then because we were
socks?
To sock preference.
No.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, he was like, socks. You pick the socks that you want to wear, and it's not like that's just how you want it.
Like,
yeah.
Like dating preferences.
Yeah. Yeah. And
sorry.
No, you're good. But because it was a lecture, and there like we couldn't discuss it. So I think that would have been a lot easier to confront in a discussion section. And also, I agree that in some ways I feel like there's an elephant in the room we're not addressing, and that's Duke's active participation in being a residential school and being built by slave labor, and those denied access to basic civil liberties. And if we had a discussion section, we might be able to sort of steer the course content a little bit more.
And apply it to Duke. Yeah.
Smith introduced himself as a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation.
Yeah. Recently, the Duke Native American Student Alliance has been trying to advocate for more resources for Native students, because Duke was a residential school. And so this class, I think, gives me the tools necessary to analyze the power relationships and these inequities. And like this class we had today, you can see these trends play out in many parts of the world and throughout history.
Lo Schiavo was the student who would have liked to delve more deeply into Duke power relationships.
Specifically, I like took a really awesome house course run by the Mitchell White House, which is the like Black living and learning community on campus. That was last fall. Two students like really dug deep into the history of Duke and racism. So we learned about like labor unions, about the Alden Building takeover, etc. And so I really wanted to see how this course would like take on that history. I'm disappointed that it's not, but I hope that, I think this is a good foundation for like future iterations of the course to tackle that history.
A good foundation for sure. And Haney feels that's exactly the point.
And what I thought would happen, and I think it's the best way to approach it, is to do what we do as academics, is do evidence-based course. And then when you start talking about an Alden Building takeover, now you have a context which when you can better understand those kinds of events or to better discuss those kinds of events. But without knowing some basic foundational facts and events about race and U.S. history and politics and science, you can't have, I think, very good, productive conversations about these sticky issues that come up, or like a takeover or a renaming of a building. It's what we do as academics, at least from the social science perspective. And I think that's what you do. And then let people look at facts and information and draw their own conclusions or enter into debate, having something to debate rather than, issues that become political without any foundation. So I'm happy that the course has turned out that way. And,
Pickett agreed.
Like coming in, I expected to learn more about like Black history, but to learn more about like other cultures and how their races were affected and their cultures are affected is definitely interesting. And how some of them like connect together, I found very interesting. So.
Graduate student Adrian Jones wondered whether concerns about fraught conversations in discussion groups were justified, given that any student taking this course had consciously opted in.
Like, certainly there are concerning things that may be happening or that could happen, but I would also say we might be experiencing some selection effects too. I think people who chose to take this class did so because they're interested in being here and they're interested in learning. So I think that kind of sharing and communal opportunity that you all would like to have really could be a great space for you to connect with one another.
In fact, Jones felt she could have been learning more as a graduate student had she had the chance to shepherd students through those discussions. She enjoyed reading their written work.
But for someone like me, who aspires to be a professor one day, I'm also thinking about strategies to actually implement this information into courses that I teach. The best ways to engage with students, how to really push their kind of critical thinking and their critical analysis and their writing skills. So I'm learning just as much from the students as they are from us, and learning quite a lot about how to be in the classroom and the type of teacher I would like to be.
The students asked about the material, talked among themselves, moving along both their academic understanding of race and their capacity to discuss it. Their discussions with me became almost a de facto discussion session, and their professors heard them. The second iteration of the course, running in fall 2022, meets biweekly, once for lecture, once for discussion. Next week, on the race course. The students have discussed why they took this course. We take a moment to hear from professors.
And so, honestly, I part of why I agreed to join on is I don't think it should only be, people of color that say studying race is important.
That's next episode of The Race Course from Duke Magazine.